Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. We also thank Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming up on 8 o'clock, and up next is more talk radio. You can call in at 503-231-8187 to make your comments or ask your questions. Today's subject is going to be triggering psychological triggers after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m. at the Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard in Portland. Information about the Community Advisory Board can be found at kboo.fm/cab.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. Human Solutions is partnering with KBOO and ERCO to say thank you to their donors and to celebrate being included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. The evening includes beer and snacks as a way of saying thanks for giving to all their supporters. Again, that's Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Are listening to More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott on KBOO.fm, your community radio station. And today is Monday, November 20th, 2017. And as Joe mentioned earlier, we're planning to have a conversation about triggers, not literal triggers, but maybe psychological triggers, things that might put you at a place of not being very comfortable. We thought that considering the times we are living in, it is important to be aware and to prepare by strengthening our ability to respond and talking about what does it mean to try to develop a community where all are heard and, more important, be able to negotiate ways in which to communicate and to create a more equitable society. Joining us this day is Andre Middleton. I'm going to make sure I assume this is correct, your correct title, Director of Equity and Digital Inclusion.
Yes.
For Open Signal, right?
Yes.
Okay. What exactly is that? And tell us about Open Signals.
Great. Well, good morning, everybody. It's Andre Middleton. Wow. As a Director of Equity and Digital Inclusion, it was my goal to try and get Open Signal to adopt a lot of their policies, asset allocation, programming, by looking through an equity lens, mm-hmm. With a focus on how do we enable, facilitate more young brown people, more people of color, to utilize the digital tools and to get access to the resources that the digital lifestyle provides for so many people. So whether that means specific workshops, whether that means scholarship programs, but how do we acknowledge some of the systemic and issues of white supremacy that are happening all around us, and how do we use the resources at Open Signal as a tool to mitigate that, at least within that environment? So that's been a lot of what I do.
Excellent. It sounds like very important work, and I guess you are at that. We are in a very important part in terms of history and especially where we're living at in geography, to begin to address those issues in a way in which more people, more organizations look through that equity lens and develop.
Well, I appreciate that, but it's a challenge for a lot of organizations, especially if they aren't doing it from day one.
Yes.
There are a lot of organizations that have been here for 20, 30, 40 years, and while with the best of intentions, they say, hey, we want to start acknowledging our role in making the world a better place, our role in the gentrification that's hitting the city, our role in the marginalization of a lot of peoples in the city. Yet there's a lot of work to be done. Just saying that you want to do that is not enough. It takes training, it takes effort, it takes sacrifice, it takes pain, it's a journey. And wishing to complete that journey is not enough. There's a lot of work to be done. One of my side projects is I started a nonprofit called Friends of Noise. And because we started that nonprofit just a couple of years ago, I've been able to infuse working through a equity lens from day one. So we can say, hey, when we look at spaces to do our concerts, we want to do them in underserved neighborhoods. We want to do them in black and brown neighborhoods. When we're looking for permanent space, we want it to be in East Portland because that's where so many young brown kids are ending up these days due to gentrification. We don't want to find a space downtown, even though that might be more fiscally advantageous. There's more transportation. There's already an ecosystem designed for entertainment. Yes. How do we create new cultural hubs that are sustainable within the neighborhoods that they serve? How do we make it easier for young people to participate in telling their stories, telling their narratives, and being creative without having to go to the Schnitz or Portland Five or Portland Center Stage? And those are all wonderful places, but it takes a bit more effort to get there, and we're trying to do stuff within people's neighborhoods
And as you suggested, it might be easier to begin or an organization. It's much more difficult to transform a group, an individual group, a group that has a history, a way of doing things, and to suddenly put a pause and saying, we're going to try to do things different. it's much more, I don't know if it's much more, but it's a different challenge than starting from the ground up.
Without a doubt, you know, I'm actually taking an evaluation class at PSU on program evaluation. And one of the things that they hit me to was the notion of stakeholders. Idea of stakeholders. And every organization has many, many, many different stakeholders with different agendas and different needs and different goals. And, you know, when it comes to issues of equity, when it comes to issues of justice, you need more than just one or two stakeholders who are dedicated and working towards that positive end. You need to have a polarity. You need to have more than just a consensus. You need to have a majority. And unless you have that majority, whether it's whoever's, you know, washing dishes up to the CEO, there needs to be, you know, an acknowledgement and a real work towards doing that work at so many different levels. And it just can't be top down. It just can't be bottom up. So, So I look forward to having this conversation. I look forward to engaging and continuing this conversation across a variety of spectrums and forums.
You're listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO, your community radio station. I'm Cecil Prescott, and I'm speaking with Andre Middleton, the Director of Equity and Digital Inclusion for OpenSignal. And we wanted to have you as part of this conversation, partly because of who you are and what you do.
Thank you.
And as we think about our society and how do people confront, challenge, transform their community, their organizations, and their families themselves, especially when it seems we're living in a time where people are on edge in many ways. And this term, psychological trigger, I mean, it's a term that I heard often. Mm-hmm. And when you hear that term, how would you define it?
I would define it that we are all coming from specific places of lived experience. And in many times, we may share a lived experience with other people, even though they might not be living our experience. We've got commonalities. And especially when it comes to issues of injustice, when it comes to issues of violence, when it comes to issues of degradation, you know, those cause injury.
Yes.
And those can cause scarring. And those scarring may not be visible as a scar on your arm, but they're still scarring and there's still healing to be done within us. And while we are in this process of healing, I think a trigger is something that acerbates and rips open that scar in a significant way for the individual. And that causes a reaction within that person that we may not be able to see, but it's real. You know, it's not just real for them, it's real for us. Because if they're in our lives, if we love them, we care for them, we like them, they're our neighbors, they're our friends, we need to acknowledge their pain that they're going through. And if we cannot work to mitigate it, how do we work to minimize, to make sure that we are not adding to that pain? So that's how I would define triggering.
And acknowledging it, the individual first has to acknowledge when it occurs. And I think people might be so engaged in living their lives that we may not even be aware of those triggers, consciously aware. And it creates challenges when you interact with other people in an organization. In the type of work you're doing, looking through a justice lens, I think you might need to be aware of those points that will raise people, which will set people off, for a better word.
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because in many ways, you're right. I think the first step to I don't want to say the word coping, but mitigating the impact that triggers can have on us is acknowledging for ourselves and the individual that I am hurt and I've got trauma and I've got scarring. You know, we live in a country, we live in a society that, you know, advocates stoicism and advocates, you know, individual, you know, strength and a certain level of invulnerability. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the work that I'm doing these days is really focused on listening with intent, listening without judgment. And while we need to do that with each other, we need to do it with ourselves, too. We need to listen to ourselves and see the impacts of the world is having on us, and how do we, you know, mitigate that within ourselves? How do we take the first step in healing so that we can communicate with our brothers and sisters, hey, I'm in a healing process here, so realize that, you know, I mean, you're not gonna walk into a hospital and start pushing over machines and doing stuff, because you know that's a healing space. Mm. You know, you're not gonna walk into a hospital, you know, smoking a blunt or doing whatever you gotta do. You know, this is a healing space. How do we make sure that people around us know that we're in healing spaces every single day of our lives?
You mentioned, as part of your work, and as you gave an example, is looking at spaces in East Portland where a lot of people of color are. And when you said it, I, you know, within me it said, you know, darn it, you know, it was like, what happened? I mean, and as I, sometimes when I am going through this community where KBOO is situated, I can, you know, everything is going okay, and then I either look up and see something that used to be there that's not there, and then either I might become angry or sad, and part of that is just not being aware when it occurs or how it may occur. And what, you know, and people in communities have different coping tools, as you suggested. When you work in deciding those specific spaces that you would like to use, did this develop more from a philosophical point that we need to support our community, or as your organization decide what to do? How does that emerge in terms of deciding what's really important for our communities and individuals?
You know, in all fairness, I am, you know, me and Friends of Noise, and me as Andre Middleton, and me as Open Signal, you know, we are just, you know, points in a constellation. You know, we are part of a community. And I would not be so bold to suggest that I figured out, you know, from, you know, I guess, you know, what I'm trying to say is that I'm just trying to make a positive change.
Yes.
And I want to make it a positive change that is sustainable. And from my best recollection, sustainability has to be built in from day one. We have to at least be thinking about it. So, you know, I'll admit, I don't have it all worked out. It's a day-by-day process. But I think that, you know, acknowledging that change happens, we've got to adapt, we've got to respond, we've got to live, and we've got to be nimble, and we've got to be steadfast. I mean, there's so many paradoxes. Yes. Between being nimble and being steadfast.
Yeah.
About being flexible but being strong, but somehow we have to do it, you know, somehow we have to continue to do that work.
Yeah. Well, as you described it, it reminds me of one, being aware. And the words you use, it's flexible, and also working through it. It's a work in process. So part of the challenge is to be aware, and I'm not sure the word patience, but to work in such a way that things are in a state of flux. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what may seem okay at this given moment and time may not be at another point in time.
Right. It's funny. I recently, you know, have been able to see more work done by Reverend Martin Luther King. And something that struck me was the notion of the long game. And we heard President Obama talk about that a lot, too. You know, hey, when they go low, we go high. But having an eye on the long game. And, you know, I have no doubt that Reverend King while he was, you know, he said in his speech, I might not be there when you get there, you know, and he was right about that, you know, and while he may not have been able to see the amount of progress we've made, he saw in his day and time the amount of work that needed to be done. And in many times that work is beyond us. And I think that goes to the notion of, you know, of triggering is that, you know, as a collective, how are we working together to move the ball forward? And sometimes you can't leave people behind. You know, sometimes you have to say, guess what? We're going to slow down a little bit so that that soldier, so that that woman, so that child can be a part of this healing process. We're not just going to press on and say, I'm good, and then leave people behind. So I think it's really important that when we, you know, acknowledge the pain people are in, we acknowledge the pain that we're in, that we're trying to do it in a community-minded way that doesn't leave people behind. And I think that's something that the conversation about triggering can draw attention to.
And I think one of the ways in which this work include in terms of not leaving people behind is how do we develop those ties, perhaps cross-generational, so that we are not so focused on me, our generation, our people, and in terms of seeing that long game, to share in insights. It's not, you know, one side older to youngest, but it goes back and forth.
Well, that's at the heart of Friends of Noise. You know, we create intergenerational spaces, multicultural spaces, for young people and older people to share in arts and culture and music. And that's at the heart. I mean, that's part of what we do. But, you know, there's so many incredible people, whether it's Black Butterfly, S. Renee Mitchell, Sherita Town, Bart Fitzgerald, Shamia Bashir, who are doing that right now, who are engaging with young people. Think about Deep Underground. Think about Natalie Figueroa and YGA and YGB. There are people out there, especially in the context of the arts, that are doing it. But, you know, there are names that I don't even know yet through, you know, so many. I mean, it's happening. It's definitely happening. Good morning.
Good morning. So I've been sitting here listening to you talk about healing spaces and leave no soldier behind, in terms of making sure we're all kind of caught up in that flow that's going to take to healing, lead to healing, and to help everybody kind of regain equilibrium in a state of flux. Okay, so now that you all have been able to say all the nice words, here I'm going to come in and I have to put the ugly hammer down.
Truth.
Okay, so here's the thing about a trigger phrase. When you talk about being involved and looking at the long game, you got to have a spot at the table. And that means that you got to be strong enough to withstand the fact that there's people who are in the planning process who don't want you at the table because that's part of their long game. So the process and the dynamic has, I'm not going to use a pretty word like metamorphosize. I'm going to say mutated. It's got a certain ugly connotation to it. And then you've got new tactics come out. Now, the word dog whistle politics might be new, but the process isn't new. Okay, and dog whistle politics in a way is related to trigger statements in that it's kind of like, okay, I see people trying to hang in there for the long haul and be part of the planning process. And my planning process with my crew was we were going to get rid of them and they're hanging tight. What can we do to make them feel like they really need to leave? Oh, let's find some words, let's find some actions, let's get some type of dynamic going on that's just vague enough to not be specifically get out, but it's irritating enough to make them flinch every so often with a memory of the fact that, well, maybe we haven't made it to the mountaintop and maybe they moved the mountain and didn't tell us. And maybe it's just a whole bunch of smoking clouds up there and they're saying, yeah, this is the mountaintop, when the mountaintop been moved when we was, you know, blinking. So people now will use phrases like, well, you're just such a snowflake, darling. You can't handle the stress of being here at the table with the big dogs. Maybe you've done your work and it's time for you to rest. And maybe let us carry your water. I mean, you've been here long enough. We kind of know what you need, what you've been asking for. Why don't you just go ahead and rest and let us take care of your interests? And, you know, if you say anything against it, it's like, but we're just here for your best interest. What did we say? Didn't we just say we were here for you? So why are you giving us stink eye? What's the mean mug all about? And really what it is that little subtle dynamic, and I remember hearing it expressed as racism 2.0, you know, some years ago. And then, you know, now flash forward a few years and it's dog whistle politics. And basically what you have is not something that's new. It's just repackaged, playing on people's weariness and battle fatigue, and oh, they had a word for it, post-traumatic stress. And so when you work at doing things through an air quotes, y'all, lens of equity, you know, people say, oh, you got those rose-colored glasses on again. You know, oh, you people, I admire your tenacity. So in this whole little soliloquy I just laid down there, folks, if you're listening, I'm sure you've heard a few of those trigger statements. All this is a new way of getting under your skin and working with you. Yet, the opposition has become so sophisticated that you've got what seems like just a low-key appeal to you to kind of stick with it but broaden your approach, but at the same time try not to get upset at the fact that when you call it out and you try to pull that sheet off the ghost, you know, you try to keep that kind of aggressive pushing away in focus, you're watching it change almost in front of you, you know. And I don't know if anybody listening can remember the first time they heard that phrase, when you're just being a snowflake. But one of the reasons I found a need to have this conversation is that by repackaging words, by rebranding, by shifting the focus a little bit, it makes it harder for people to stay at the table and stay involved. And so that's one of the reasons why I would like to hear from the public, and not only how they recognize and share their awareness and their tactics for addressing triggers, but how they help people understand that these things are real. This is nothing new. It's just the what do you want to call it? The repackaging of racism, of classism, of supremacy, of sexism. It comes in a lot of little forms, but it's just kind of like the 4.0 version, if you will. And join us for the conversation. Being in media, Andre gets to see it and help visualize it in terms of creating access. But a lot of us maybe don't have that opportunity. Maybe we would like to talk to somebody like Andre who helps us find new strategies for dealing with it. Cecil and I, by talking on the radio, we have an opportunity sometimes to give pushback when people are giving us their versions of trigger words or their versions of pushback. But maybe you don't have that opportunity and you'd like to talk with us and share some ideas about creating new strategies for pushing back against trigger words or the fact that people don't even want to acknowledge that they exist. You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the city. The phone number is 503-231-8187. Join in the conversation. So, okay, now I put the hammer down. I made it nice and ugly. So, Andre, step in.
I want to say right off the bat, it is such a joy to be at the table with someone who was so just so smooth and professional and practiced. That really, no, seriously, I learn every time I come here. I agree with you 99.9%. I really do. The notion that our ancestors have gone through so much and they didn't have the language, they didn't have the avenue to say, you know, I'm just going to, you know, sit down, put down this hoe, and just I'm going to weep about this for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the opportunity to say, hey, you know, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to see the cross burning and I'm just going to fade into the background, you know, right. There's work to be done. And from my perspective in this conversation, I was just suggesting, how can we create our own table to make sure that our people have the support that they need to continue the struggle, to continue the fight? But I completely
and
agree.
And to practice.
Yes.
Fighting back,
yes.
You know, because that's the big thing nowadays, you know, because I love what you're doing about creating a table, and I love what you're doing in terms of Open Signal maintaining a space at the table. You know, I used to serve on the board there for a long time before it was Open Signal, and it was Portland Community Media. And one of the things, or Portland Cable Access, actually, one of the things that's really important, though, is we cannot forget that even though we create our own tables in this practice, we still have a right to be at the main table. And folks forget that sometimes, and they want to edge us out. Well, you've done enough work now, and things are changing. And, you know, if we could all just agree to stick together on this, everybody would be all right. Yeah, I believe that, except for the fact that now there's no bus service to the hinterlands where you push me. So I guess I need to stay at this table, you know.
I completely agree.
So we do have a couple of folks online who want to join in the conversation. And I'm glad you do agree 99.9%, and we won't talk about that 0.1% where you don't agree, because that's also where solutions lie. Good morning. You're on the air. Bill?
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes. I often say that sometimes, you know, it's kind of ironic for someone to say that you have a seat at the dinner table, but we're picking from different menus.
Yes.
So I'm going to give you the small menu, and I have the menu with all the options. But anyway, I wanted to comment on the significance of being able to have conversation that is history-based, because often that is discounted when we are talking about solutions to problems that aren't really new problems. Like, yes, you've said, they've been repackaged to where they appear to be this new thing, but it's really not. So sometimes just having conversation and educating one another about what the past has looked like to kind of shed light on the fact that many of the things we're arguing about are not new and they're not complicated. It's just the rehashing of some of the things that we never got beyond because we stopped having conversation, or we tell people, get over it.
Yes.
And I often tell people, if we don't allow victimizers to go into court and tell people that they victimized how to get over it, we would be appalled if that happened. So why does that often happen in the conversations that we have in the general public about people who have been, I guess, marginalized or oppressed or whatever you want to call it? But thank you too for the conversation, because this is really the key to educating as well. Thank you.
I wonder if Andre might have some insight, because as you suggested, Bill, the need to include or remember the struggles before, you know, oftentimes in conversations, I think we must be much more inclusive, not only, you know, multi-generational, but also to hear the voices of those who are no longer here. They deserve, and their insights deserve a seat at the table. So how do we do that and don't have and get beyond the fact of the rolling of the eyes, or, you know, there he goes again talking about how things were generations ago?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that a lot of our culture is based on acknowledgement and respect and reverence for our ancestors,
mm-hmm.
and acknowledging that, you know, the their struggle, their work, their blood still flows through us. And I think that, you know, America's done a really good job of separating us from that. America's done a wonderful job, especially, you know, whether it's the Great Passage, whether it was just taking over our language, taking over our religion, you know, undermining our spirituality. So, you know, I think understanding the true power of community, the true power of connecting with our elders and connecting with the elders of our elders is an important part of the process, because that's where so much of our strength can come from. But that takes a lot of new learning. It takes a lot of new practice. And that's not going to come from schools. It's not going to come from our government. It's got to come from our parents and our grandparents. It's got to come from, you know, my aunt that lives around the corner, you know. So, that's how I would approach that, to acknowledge that, you know, there's real power in our history, there's real power in our ancestors, but we've been living in a country that has been undermining and cutting us off from that power from day one.
Yes. Well, very intentional, very what is the word I want, very strategically.
True.
And again, this is their long game. What do I mean? And who do I mean by they? Well, you know, I'm going to acknowledge that it's not always just racism, okay? But I don't want people to forget that in terms of giving us the societal, the governmental, the economic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, foundation and structure that this country enjoys, it was based on racism, okay? Let us not forget that, you know? So when you get through enjoying all of the other accolades for folks who have also worked in a struggle from different perspectives, do not forget that racism is the bedrock. We do have another caller online, and so let's get to our caller, Cody, and continue the conversation. And it's 503-231-8187. Good morning, Cody.
Good morning, Celeste.
I heard a sigh.
Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I heard a sigh, Cody. I heard deep sigh.
Oh, it's all beautiful.
Okay, and good, because I was appreciating being tired, though, you know.
Well, here it is. You guys are completely 100% correct. And I'll give you 99.9% myself. Here's the issue that too many African Americans have been overlooking in this country, is that we do not own and control our own media. All right? Because you're right. Sometimes it's not racism. You're absolutely right. And what it is that there are people with racist underpinnings who will prejudice other people who don't have racist underpinnings against African Americans. Now, the issue here is then the next phase is, well, how do you do that? You must control your own narrative. We don't have our own Telemundo. That's the problem. Until we could control our own narrative, we will always be at the mercy of everyone else who controls their own narrative.
Okay, now put a period right there and let Andre step in real quick.
Cody, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling. And on many levels, there's a lot of agreement here. You know, back in the day, we did own Jet Magazine. We did own Black Enterprise Magazine. We owned
Johnson Publications.
Johnson Publications.
Mm-hmm.
In this modern day and age, though, there's been a real decentralization as well as a consolidation. We live in an age of paradox. We live in an age of, of one level where Black Twitter is moving people to do things, where Black Lives Matter will have $0 in the bank account, yet they have mobilized hundreds of thousands of people around the world. So while Mr. Zuckerberg owns Facebook, no doubt about that, you know, while Mr. Gates owns Microsoft, I think Black and brown people have always found ways of communicating with each other, whether it was a little black book telling you where you could stay, where you shouldn't stay.
That's right.
You know, knowing our history, there have been ways that we've been able to communicate between each other, you know, and not need to be a part of their narrative, not need to be a part of their power structure. And we are doing that yet again. So while we may not have our own Telemundo, right now we're having a conversation between three of us, four of us, five of us right now.
Okay, now let me jump in there and say something too for Andre and Cody. And I got two parallel statements, so I'm gonna try to do this. Forgive me, y'all, my brain doesn't work like a lot of folks. This is ADD, whatever. Okay, first, with regard to the Little Black Book, here's a kind of like a side street, if you will. We have our very own Little Black Book here that's being stepped on in Portland, and that's the Golden West. Okay, the hotel, that which is where black folks stayed in Portland, and especially the railroad workers. Now, there are people, and I'm trying to remember my homeboy's name, it'll come to me, who have been working really hard to get the people who own that to memorialize it with regard to the black community, and has not been able to get them to do squat. So this is one reason why it's important that we do have those side narratives, you know. Oh, thank you, Cecil. Kudos and a shout out to Will Bennett. Thank you, Will. Will's been on shows I've had before, and I really appreciate his work. Okay, but here's the problem, okay? It's not about us owning our own media, because you may have Telemundo, but there are still people changing the narrative for folks of Latin descent. So having their own stations ain't done squat, because you still have people like Trump who is demonizing, you know, an entire cultural swath. Okay, so it's about forcefully and repeatedly and dealing with the triggers of correcting false narratives regardless of the media. Now, one of the way black folks, you know, connect, Cody, is like, have you ever checked out Kenja?
I'm aware of a lot of our fractured media.
Right,
and
right.
When I say fractured media,
I hear you.
I hear you too.
Mm-hmm. And when I say fractured media, what I'm saying is that we're not speaking as one voice. And Telemundo, you're right, is it appears not to be helping them, but it will help them weather any type of storm against them as far as media is concerned. And it'll be a place where all of the Latino Mexicans can actually listen and say, this is what we need to do to operate somewhere close to a united front. Something African Americans used to do,
but we're not monolithic, Cody. But we're not monolithic, so I'm not comfortable with the idea of speaking one voice. What do you mean when you say speaking one voice?
What I mean is speaking one voice is that at least everyone is on the same page and they are aware. We're so fractured now that one side isn't aware of what the other side is saying. And as a result, it makes us that much easier to...
Can you give me an example of what you mean? Because we're all deeply... We got those thinking faces on, so we're trying to get with you.
An amazing discovery that could revolutionize African-Americans' place and solidify our place, not only in history, but as a very unique creature of the United States of America, a pure creature of the United States of America. And then someone makes this amazing discovery way, 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 way over there. But we're so fractured, it doesn't trickle to the meta level with the means fast enough amongst African Americans, because we have our own delusions amongst ourselves.
So Cody, Andre, you know, mentioned earlier in terms of how black folks have always used, subverted, and find ways to get the word out. So whether it's in mm-hmm. you know, these days Black Twitter, or whether it, you know, and my great grandparents, you know, through music, there's different ways. And so the reality is, I think you're correct, we don't own. And I think I might I might differ from Celeste when she was talking about a seat at the main table. I don't think that may be necessary as long as we continue to have our own tables and build on those.
Okay, well, I hear snaps.
You were onto something when you said that, because you said we build our own table. And the second that table is built, what mm-hmm. really happens is there's an invitation to the big table instead of there being a right or an obligation to be at that table.
So, okay, now I'm going to challenge all three of you on that. Okay, and so help me, brothers, here, because I feel like we need our own table. I'm never going to disagree with you all on that, but I worry sometimes that we might get cut off, and I don't want to be an island unto ourselves, because it's real easy for people to divert traffic around you sometimes mm-hmm. and make those long-term longitudinal strategic plans without your butt, because you at your table, they say, well, you doing your own thing, and we didn't want to bother you. So Cecil and Cody and Andre, come on.
Well, on one level, like I said, there's a whole lot of room for agreement here, but mm-hmm. I think we have to acknowledge, and Cody, I want to give you props for this. When we did have a Black Wall Street, when we did have our own cities, when we have, hey, the Nation of Islam, what do? They attack, they destroy, they tear it down. They don't allow that foundation to grow, mm-hmm. to be built upon. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, where I'd see Jewish restaurants and Spanish restaurants and Chinese food restaurants. And those are just the beginning stages of them creating their own economic destiny, their own economic right. power. Right. And you're right. In white America, whenever they see Black people develop that power base, mm-hmm. they tear it down.
Right.
I'm suggesting that in the year 2017 and forward, after having a president like Barack Obama, after providing an example for so many young people who are still not even at voting age yet, who are still going through school, those are the people who are saying, wow, we can do this. We can resist the torches. We can resist the alt-right in ways that maybe I didn't realize when I was their age. So I'm just suggesting that creating our own table can be the foundation to launch from. And then once we have that strong foundation, we got that fallback position. That's when we can go to the other table and say, you know, whatever you do, I know I got mine back home. You can't snowflake me. You can't make me feel weak. You can't undermine me, because I know I got my power base at home. For many, many years, we have been denied that power base. They have divided us. They have said, oh, Farrakhan is evil. Oh, but King is good. Oh, X is evil. But this one's good. But Andrew Jackson is good. You know, Andrew Young is good. So mm-hmm. there has to be ways for us to, like Cody's right, come together, but to do so in a way that is moving us forward.
Okay.
Your guess is completely correct. And he said a very important thing. And I could explain it in three words: economics. You know, it all comes back to whenever African Americans were at the cusp of becoming economically independent, a lot of weird things started to happen.
Amen to that. But you know what, Cody? We got another caller.
Okay.
Thank you for being here. Don't forget, you know, you can always hit us up with your thoughts and ideas on our KBOO page, or you can send us information to moretalkradio@gmail.com. Because I love your thoughts, even though sometimes you and I may not be approaching it from the same place, it helps give a broader perspective.
Yes, it's important that we could have these conversations in the first place and trade them, because African Americans are at a very dangerous crossroads in this country if we're not aware of it. And like your guest said, that we have the Black Wall Street and all that, but no one's telling these stories. And this is, and when we have our own media and we control our own media, we can tell these stories and say, look, we were treated just like the Jews in Nazi Germany. Where's our reparations? Have a good day.
Okay. Thank you, Cody.
Okay, you know, it occurred to me when you were talking about, you know, being aware of the past and how Black people have been treated, and every time something comes up, it's torn down. When you were referring to President Obama, and one might affirm or disagree with certain policies, but I think by being aware of our history, being aware of Black Wall Street, being aware of
Golden West,
and of Golden West, but and also being aware, for me, I think it's very interesting. Go back 125 years ago to Reconstruction, and there was that moment where there was Black political power, and what happened mm-hmm. after 12 years mm-hmm. seems very similar to what's happening in the national government after Obama's regime. The dismantling.
Yes, the deconstruction.
Of anything mm-hmm. that has Obama's name on it.
Or has support to minorities.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so to be aware of this, that, when we build up, people are going to attack and destroy. And mm-hmm. we just, it goes around and around. I don't know if we ever get out of the cycle, but we need to be aware of the history and build upon it.
Yes. So you are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland. Coming up at 9 o'clock will be the Old Mo Variety Hour. Single payer health care, and the best way to achieve it is what? Plus racism in Clark County, and a look at how family life and gender are represented in the 1947 movie, Miracle on 34th Street. Locust Focus at 10 with Barbara Bernstein. The Wilderness Society talks about threats to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. At 11 on Intersections Radio, Aaliyah Malik talks about her memoir, The Home That Was Our Country, a reflection on serious history. 11:30 Radio Zine with Lena Biswas talking about Indian woman biker rebels. All right. And you know what? This is all about you here on KBOO, where you can get informed and you can get involved. Don't forget, support KBOO at KBOO.fm. Click on donate. We're going to go to our next caller. Thank you for being patient, Tim.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I agree with basically most of what you guys are talking about, but the last caller had that one thing where you was calling for one voice.
Uh-huh.
And I've been an organizer in the past, both in the United States and overseas, and we never wanted to have just one voice. Unity of purpose, yes. Unity of purpose. You know, basic things that all the different diverse groups can agree on, because the Black people in America are not one monolithic group with
yeah.
one opinion. They're divided, and many have different experiences. Yes. The recent immigrants from Africa, they never had this history of slavery. Their ancestors might have been complicit in the slave trade. The thing is that there's, you have just one voice is kind of counter to the whole point of the revolution and change and liberation. You need to have a variety of voices.
I think what you're talking about, Tim, is well, not only are you voicing kind of my concerns, but I think what I'm hearing is a refinement, again, of language, just like we were talking about the whole idea of trigger words being something to use to get up under the skin. But it's just a refinement of an old technique. What you are offering is a refinement of how we might want to characterize that step forward. What do you think, Andre? You engage with people a lot. How does that one purpose, many voices sound?
I think it sounds really well. And I think, as we talk about diversity, diversity is not a black and white. Diversity needs to be seen as on a spectrum. So I completely agree with the caller in suggesting that, having multiple perspectives leads to a stronger drive, leads to a stronger outcome, because, you're not going to have blind spots. You know, there may be something that you see that I don't see. And if I'm just demanding that you fall in line behind me, I'm never going to see what you have to see. You know, a big thing that I like to talk about in my practice is no big eyes, no little U's. And if you can, you know, go through life with that being a major part of how you look at people, how you look at the world, you're always going to be open to what other people have to say.
I have one question for you. And am I still on the air there?
Yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Okay. The caller also mentioned reparations. And I'm interested in reparations. United States is not the only country that built its wealth on the backs of black slaves, right?
There are there's quite a few.
Yes, many countries complicit. Many African kingdoms or tribes were complicit. Right. So my question is this. Have there been other movements in countries that had slaves to get reparations? And have anyone actually done that? And how has it worked out? And are the people, the descendants of the slaves, are they happy with what happened? Is it anywhere in the world where this has happened?
You know, that's a question I'm personally not prepared to answer right now, but I think it's a good one. I think it bears some research. Andre?
I would agree. I'm not educated on that, but I do have to say that I think that America is in somewhat of a unique place in the context of the power and wealth that America has amassed in direct relation to the slave trade. No doubt that, you know, European countries, you know, colonized and extracted resources, but America, you know, literally weaponized the extracting of human resources in a way that I don't think too many other countries did.
Well, the thing, too, about it.
Brazil.
Well, that's a good one, but we got to move because we got a couple of more callers, Tim. But that's a good question, and like I said, that bears some thought and some development. So stick with us on that one.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you, brother and sister.
Uh huh. Really quickly, I'm trying not to lose my train of thought. Well, I lost it. The train pulled out without me. Let's just go to our next caller.
Sean, good morning.
Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, you guys. Well, listen, I won't try to take up much of your time. I just want to, you know, I had to call in because I'm currently reading Yuval Noah Harari's, I don't know if you've heard of both his books, but his follow-through was Homo Deus, and talking about where the future of sapiens and the human beings are going into the, you know, into the future. But specifically, you know, ironically, I just read through the section, he has a chapter called The Storytellers. And he talks about, really, we've gotten to a point where, you know, we need to, if we're going to really understand where we're going, we have to decipher, and I'm quoting here, decipher the fictions that give meaning to the world, because basically we are a society, a species that is built on fictional myths that we have created over time. And specifically the point he goes into is talking to that time where we went from hunter-gatherers into the agricultural revolution, and where we went from an inner subjective reality of believing into ancestral spirits and seashells and so forth, then into the agricultural revolution, and how the change in cognitive revolution started when it went into the ag revolution. Because from that point, he talks about, I'm just going to quote here, because it'll help make.
Okay, we do have another caller behind you, too.
I know, but I'm just going to say. So he just says, sapiens had a huge advantage following the spirits and seashells, because they allowed hundreds and sometimes thousands of people to cooperate effectively, which was far more than Neanderthals or chimps could do. But then into the ag revolution, farming made it possible to feed thousands of people in crowded cities and thousands of soldiers and disciplined armies. The inner subjective encountered a new obstacle. In order to preserve the collective myths and organize mass cooperation, early farmers relied on the data processing abilities of the human brain, which were strictly limited. And I'm just saying, that is a huge turning point, because what he's talking about is the massive change that happened in sapiens' ability to cooperate.
Hey, thank you so much. We were just about out of time.
Okay, bye-bye. Quickly, let's see. T, you only got a few seconds, but hit it.
No worries. I was just going to say thanks for what y'all are doing. But it's interesting, you know what I'm saying, to be a brother out here trying to make change and do things. But at the same time, I think your point about us being monolithic is very true, but we're also fractured as well. I just keep listening. I just wanted to throw that out there. I appreciate y'all. Thank y'all.
Thank you, T.
I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Last word, Andre?
Blessings, and thank you for having me here. I look forward to coming again at some point in the future. Your audience is on point. You're on point. I just want to say how much I appreciate being here.
Well, thank you, and you've got an open forum. Don't forget. And we want to encourage our listeners, you know, people who have not had a chance to call in because I didn't hear any women. You know, don't be shy. Call in, and you can always hit us up on our webpage at kboo.fm or at moretalkradio@gmail.com. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland. 90.7 in the metro area, 91.9 in points east, points south, 104.3 and everywhere, KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m. at the Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard in Portland. Information about the Community Advisory Board can be found at kboo.fm/cab.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. Human Solutions is partnering with KBOO and ERCO to say thank you to their donors and to celebrate being included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. The evening includes beer and snacks as a way of saying thanks for giving to all their supporters. Again, that's Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right.